Well, the last several weeks we've been talking about hope, and today I'm going to finish up this message on hope. But it's not just ordinary hope that we've been talking about, is it? It's been radical, countercultural hope. The message of hope that Jesus brings that so stands apart from culture that it's just really hard for people to grasp. We've looked at a number of different biblical stories along the way where Jesus encountered really desperate people in really desperate situations. Sometimes the person needed healing, other times they were social outcasts, and in one of the stories we looked at, the person was dead. But in each case, Jesus responded with a message of hope, a message that was counter to the culture of the day, one that was so outside of that normal culture that the people of the day had a hard time understanding it, and of course, as we know, they plotted to kill Jesus because of it. We've also mentioned in each of these messages that Jesus' hope wasn't just warm thoughts and wishful thinking, but that his message came with action and with power. Today we're going to look at one more story that brings this counterculture message of hope to another person in a desperate situation. It's the story of the woman at the well in John 5. If you have one of the green sheets, it's on there. But John 4, starting in verse 5, says this. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about the sixth hour. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" For his disciples had gone into town to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "You are a Jew, and I am a Samaritan woman. How is it that you can ask me for a drink?" For Jews do not associate with Samaritans. Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it was that asked you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." "Sir," the woman said, "you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did also his sons and his flocks and herds?" Jesus answered, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks the water I give him will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I will not get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water." He told her, "Go call your husband and come back." "I have no husband," she replied. Jesus said to her, "You are right when you say you have no husband. The fact is, you have had five husbands, and the man that you are with now is not your husband." "What you have said is quite true, sir," the woman said. "I can see you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem." Jesus declared, "Believe me, woman, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know. For salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and has now come when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in spirit and in truth." The woman said, "I know that Messiah, called Christ, is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us." Then Jesus declared, "I who speak to you am he." Just then his disciples returned and saw him talking with her, and they were surprised to find him talking with her. But no one asked, "What do you want?" or "Why are you talking with her?" Then leaving her water jar, the woman went back to the town and said to the people, "Come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Christ?" They came out of the town and made their way toward him. Then skipping ahead to verse 39, many of the Samaritans from that town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. "He told me everything I ever did." So when the Samaritans came to him, they urged him to stay with him, and he stayed 2 days. And because of his words, many more became believers. They said to the woman, "We no longer believe just because of what you said. Now we have heard for ourselves, and we know that this man really is the Savior of the world." Well, let's start by just looking at a little bit of background and history that we need to understand this story. As it briefly mentioned in the text, Jews and Samaritans hated each other. The Samaritans were considered a half-breed. They had separated themselves from the pure Jews. And so the Jews considered them a half-breed. They considered them traitors to the faith. And so Jews wanted nothing to do with them. That was the whole point of Jesus' parable of the Good Samaritan, right? Well, a good Jew would have tried anything they could to have avoided traveling through Samaria. There was a much longer route that they would always take to avoid having to go through Samaria, even though that was the shorter route. So here we clearly see Jesus going to a place where others wouldn't go just to bring his message of hope. This is very similar to what we saw last week where Jesus was hanging out with the tax collectors at Zacchaeus' house. So just like it was against the cultural norms for him to hang out with tax collectors, it's really against the cultural norms for him to be hanging out in Samaria. Then in verse 6, it tells us that it was the sixth hour, which is noon. And this is actually an important detail that we'll come back to later. Does it sound like I'm feeding back to you guys? Do you hear? No? A little bit? Well, and then in verse 7, it says, when a Samaritan woman comes to draw water, Jesus asks her this question, "Will you give me a drink?" Now, this verse introduces our main character in the story, but it also shows us a lot of other important things that we need to see here. First, the woman was alone. This was not normally the custom. They would have come in groups. The ladies would have come in groups for protection and for socialization. They also wouldn't have come at noon. This was the heat of the day. The women would have come early in the morning or in the evening, but they would not have come to the well in the middle of the day. And so that's an important note to see that it was the sixth hour of the day. This woman seems to want to go without notice. This was no doubt because of her shameful past and her reputation. But for sure, we have a woman here who has very little hope of a normal life, just like we've seen in so many of the other stories that we've looked at. Her life would have been one of solitude and embarrassment. This was a desperate woman in a desperate situation, just like we've seen in all the other stories. And now Jesus starts a dialogue with the woman by asking her a simple question of, "Will you give me a drink?" But this goes completely against culture. Completely. First of all, she's a Samaritan. Second, she's a woman. Third, she was uneducated and a commoner. And fourth, it's a man asking a woman for something. That simply would not have happened. So Jesus is going against culture to bring his message of hope. This is someone that the Pharisees wouldn't even have given the time of day to. If the Pharisees had come through and seen this woman sitting at the well, even if they didn't know her reputation, the fact that she's sitting alone at the well in the middle of the day would have been enough of a clue for them that they would have walked well clear of her and stayed away from this dreadful woman. But Jesus shows us again that he's not afraid to hang out with people who are well outside of culture. Jesus is also very clever with how he initiates his conversation as he talks about water, since they're sitting near a well. So he's talking about something that she understands, that there's a common connection with. But he also knows that from this starting point, he can steer the conversation toward the kingdom. Verse 8, it tells us that the disciples had gone into town to buy food. See, this continues to show us how counterculture Jesus was willing to be, because a Jew would have never bought and eaten food in Samaria. It would have been considered unclean. There is absolutely no way a Jew would have eaten in Samaria. He would have rather starved to death. So the fact that Jesus sends his disciples to go buy the food means he's pushing them outside of their comfort zone as well. Can you imagine these poor disciples walking into town? They were like, making sure that no one sees them because, man, if somebody else sees them buying food in a Samaritan town, what a scandal. But it doesn't matter to Jesus. He knows that these people need his message of hope. Then in verse 9, the Samaritan woman responds to his request for water and says, "You are a Jew, I'm a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me?" The presence of Jesus and his question are in themselves so counterculture that the woman immediately begins to object. She's objecting to the culture that Jesus brings. So if it happens to Jesus, we should expect the same response, shouldn't we? When we find ourselves in those kinds of places doing evangelism, bringing his message of hope, we should expect people to go, you shouldn't be here. You're crazy. Yeah, you're right on. We are. Verse 10, Jesus responds to her and says, if you just knew the gift that I had for you, you would have asked. This largely skirts her question, but starts to begin to steer the conversation toward the kingdom. And he does it again by steering it based on this commonality of water. But he also does it in a way to spark her interest. But notice he does not argue with her. He doesn't argue with her. He avoids her question, but he begins to steer the conversation the way he wants it to go. Now, there's a big difference here between this story and the other stories that we've looked at in this series on hope. In all the other stories, the people knew of their desperate situation. The blind man knew he was blind. The crippled man knew he was crippled. The widow, whose son had just died, she knew her son was dead. They were acutely aware of the desperate situation that they were in. But Zacchaeus, that we looked at last week, and this woman, they're both social outcasts, although completely on opposite ends of the spectrum. Zacchaeus was a social outcast because of his wealth. This woman is a social outcast because of her sinful past. But they both are desperate people in desperate situations. It's just not related. It's not as obvious because there's no physical thing. They're not blind. They're not crippled. And so part of what Jesus did with Zacchaeus and part of what he's doing here is he's helping them see the need for the kingdom. He's helping them see how desperate their situation is because they have developed coping skills to just get by. This woman is probably thinking to herself, I just hope to make it through another day. This woman is probably thinking to herself, this is as good as it gets. I'm just buying my time. But Jesus comes along with a message of hope that is so radical and so countercultural that he's willing to speak this woman, who we shouldn't be speaking to, but to help her see her need for him. To help her see the fact that she really is in a desperate situation despite physical issues like blindness or crippledness. And again, Jesus does it in a way without bringing the condemnation that the religious leaders would have brought if they had tried to do it. Verses 11 and 12, Sir, the woman said, you have nothing to draw water with, and the well is deep. Where can you get this? And then she goes on about her ancestors. So Jesus begins to steer the conversation toward the spiritual, and she can only respond with the physical. She can't even begin to comprehend what he's talking about. And in verse 12, she even gets a little argumentative. Like, hey, are you greater than our ancestors? Who do you think you are? Because she can only see it in the physical. And she can only talk about what she knows, the stories, the legends, the traditions of her ancestors. Verses 13 and 14, Jesus answered, everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life. Jesus, again, answers in the spiritual. Do you see the sharp contrast? The woman can only respond in the physical, and Jesus can only respond in the spiritual. God often works this way, though, doesn't he? We see things in the physical, but God can only see things in the spiritual. Verse 15, the woman said to him, Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming back here. So she responds just a little bit more favorably, a little bit less argumentatively, but she's still missing the point because she's still talking about physical need and physical water. It's probably because she doesn't want to keep coming here to the well in the middle of the day. She is now thinking that this will somehow supply her needs so that she doesn't have to continually be embarrassed by coming to this well at noon without the companionship of the other women. For the moment, her physical need and pain are preventing her from seeing the need for a spiritual solution. Have you ever found yourself in a place like that? Where your physical pain and your physical need is so great that you cannot see the need for a spiritual solution. Somehow the enemy, the world we live in, our flesh has a way of doing that. It makes the physical need right in front of us so ever-present, so all-consuming, that we can't see that the answer to that is a spiritual answer. We only see it as a physical problem. Verse 16, Jesus says, go get your husband and come back. So he lays out there sort of a bait question for him, doesn't he? Again, he is steering the conversation back to the message of hope, because Jesus knows what the real issue is. And so by asking the question, go get your husband, he's just guiding this conversation. The woman responds with, I have no husband. And Jesus says, you're right when you say that you have no husband. Jesus now turns to the supernatural. As I have said throughout the series on hope, that his message was not one of warm thoughts and wishful thinking, but of action and power. He has earned just enough trust with this woman that he turns it up a little bit. And he uses a word of knowledge to ask the woman a question about her husband. The woman tells Jesus what he already knows, but Jesus is baiting her into seeing her need for a spiritual solution. Verse 18 says this, the fact is you have had five husbands, and the man you have now is not your husband. What you have said is quite true. Jesus now not only has the woman's attention, he has her full undivided attention, physically and spiritually, because he now said something he could not have known. He has gone right to the heart of her issues, right to the heart of her pain, right to the place where she needs hope the most. Do you see how Jesus did that? He has gone right to the issue that presumably has her at the well in the middle of the day by herself. Vineyard, this is where we are uniquely positioned. This is where we get to make a difference, because we do this. And I'm going to share a story with you in a minute. Notice also Jesus is blunt and to the point, but not condemning or judgmental. Now the story doesn't say why she's had five husbands. But if it was from divorce, then this adds to her shame. And by the way he's bringing it up, it probably was divorce and not that she had had five husbands die. And while divorce was certainly practiced in this day and age, it was considerably more shameful. And so if she's had five husbands and been divorced, there was just a tremendous amount of shame. And so she is in this vulnerable position right now of, oh no, he's seen my past. What will he do? I'm sure in her mind she's thinking what he might do. She knows the traditions and the customs and the culture of the religious leaders. She's thinking she's about to get, at worst, or at best, a lecture, at worst, a stoning. So verse 19, the woman jumps in and quickly replies, Sir, I can see you are a prophet. The woman responds with something of this sort of, well, you have my attention. And according to my theological grid, you must be somebody important. So I'm going to try to take the attention off myself and put it back onto you. And so she asks them a question in verse 20. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. She's starting to get it. She's starting to move toward the spiritual just a little bit. But you can see there's a major element of avoidance here. Maybe this was a legit question, but I don't think so. This question would have been out of the ordinary for a woman to ask in that day. It's just not something a woman would have said. I think the question was a distraction. Again, an attempt to change the subject. Jesus has just spoken something over her, a word of knowledge, a prophetic word that went right to the heart, and it's freaking her out a little bit. And so she's trying to turn and change the subject. She doesn't want God to come too close. So before things get uncomfortable, she tries to take it to a religious argument. Well, you Jews say this, and we say this. I see this all the time. When we're doing evangelism, when we're encountering people, and they want to change the subject, they're going to go to religion or politics every time. I remember back in September when I went out to New Jersey and we were doing the training for street evangelism in New Jersey. And we took teams of people out into the trailer parks, and you guys have all heard the story with the guy with the mangled hand that got healed. Well, we were trying to pray with another man and just trying to gain a little bit of favor, a little bit of trust with him, and so we're just kind of engaging in some spiritual conversation. We're trying to move it that direction. Somehow in the conversation, it came out that I was from Chicago. And holy moly, did that dude unload on me. Let's just say he doesn't have a high opinion of some of the political people that have come out of Chicago. And so he starts F-bombing me and these politicians and all this other stuff, right? He's trying to change the subject and bait me into an argument. And so I just simply replied with, well, what our politicians really need is God directing them, don't you think? And he just went, well, yeah. I said, well, let's pray for that. And so with this man, I started praying that God would lead our politicians. And then, of course, I had a prophetic word for him, and away we went. But we don't fall into these pitfalls of trying to let people steer the arguments to politics or religion. Just don't even go there. Here in this story, Jesus is trying to give her exactly what she needs, but she can't quite accept it, and we will find the same thing. Starting in verse 21, Jesus declares, believe me, woman, a time is coming when we will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. So he goes into this explanation of what worship will look like, and that worship will be spiritual and not physical. So Jesus engages her question to a degree, but his answer is one of hope. Her question was in the physical. Which physical location should we worship? Jesus answers in the spiritual, none of them. Because God is spirit, we must worship him in spirit. What Jesus is saying is that religious tradition is not what matters. Where you worship in terms of geographic location does not matter. God is bigger than all of that. But more important, Jesus says here that God can be known. That is his message of hope in this story to this woman, is all of the religious tradition that you hold on to so dearly doesn't really matter. What matters is God can be known. And you can know him. Jesus also promises the Holy Spirit in this passage. Then in verses 25 and 26, the woman responds and says, I know the Messiah called Christ is coming, and when he comes, he will explain everything to us. Then Jesus declared, I who speak am he. Again, she tries to take it a little bit off course. She doesn't quite like his answer, and so she goes, well, I know that when the Messiah comes, he's going to give us the answer because I don't really like your answer. Little does she know, she's talking to the Messiah himself. Jesus flat out gives her the ultimate message of hope in this verse by saying that he's it. But again, this would have been very counterculture and nearly impossible for her to believe because he does not fit their idea, their description, their paradigm of what the Messiah would look like. And so she's not even thinking along the right lines yet. Verse 27, it says the disciples come back from buying lunch, but they're all afraid to say anything. So we have a little interruption in our story here as the disciples return. And they see Jesus talking to the Samaritan woman. And just seeing that, just seeing Jesus talk to this woman, it was so countercultural, it left the disciples speechless. Because they didn't know what to do. We may find the same thing. When we go to people who are so outside of our culture, they might just be like, ah, duh. Verse 28, then leaving the jar of water, the woman went back to the town. Isn't it funny? In her haste to go tell everyone else about Jesus, she leaves behind the jar of water. She has left behind the physical to go tell everyone about the spiritual. She's starting to get it, even though she doesn't realize she's starting to get it. What is ironic is that now we see this incredible eagerness to go bear witness before the people that she used to do everything she could to avoid. Hope has a way of doing that. She used to avoid the townspeople. That's why she's at the well at noon. And now she's running back to go tell the very people that used to pile shame on her and condemn her about what she has just heard from Jesus. That is what the message of hope will do. The best evangelist is also the most recent believer. Verse 29, the woman comes into the town and says, "Come see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Christ?" Now, we don't know if this is an exaggeration or if Jesus said a whole bunch of other things, gave her a bunch of other words of knowledge. But whatever the case is, it doesn't matter because this message brought hope. Jesus got through to her with a word of knowledge, action, and power. This brought hope to her that her life could finally be different. You know, this past week, Eric and Candace and Scott and June went with me up to a pastors and leaders retreat, a Vineyard pastors and leaders retreat in Green Lake, Wisconsin. And on Wednesday afternoons, they always have this thing where you can sign up to get prophetic prayer. You sign up on a time slot, and you get 15 minutes, and you come in, and they'll pray prophetically over you. And I had been asked to be one of the persons doing the praying, and so I asked Candace to join me. And so we're praying for people, and this one young woman comes up to us. And we would always start by asking, well, is there anything in particular you want us to kind of pray towards? Or you just want us to go for it and see what the Lord says? And she said, well, I just want to know my future. I just want to know what God has for me and what I'm supposed to do, which is a common question from someone her age. And so we start to pray. But immediately what the Lord shows me is that she's been sexually abused. It didn't seem obvious. The young lady was very well put together, very attractive, very well dressed. You could tell she was incredibly intelligent. And so I kind of just stood there for a little bit, gulp. And I just couldn't get past it. I knew this was it. And so finally I just asked her, I said her name, and I said, you know, we just kind of have to swing at the pitches here, and this is what I felt the Lord has shown me. Have you ever been sexually abused? And immediately her head went down and the tears just started to come. She was looking for a physical answer. What am I supposed to do with my life? But Jesus says, no, you need a spiritual solution to your physical problem. And then real clearly, I hear another word that just described the type of sexual abuse. I won't even say it, but... And so I just asked her, was it this? And a gush of more tears, and she shook her head, yes. And we continued to pray and minister to her a little bit, and then I asked her, I said, have you ever gotten counseling for this, or have you ever had prayer ministry for this before? And her answer stunned me. She said, no. I've never told anyone before. Here is a woman with a deep, dark, horrible secret. She's been sexually abused by someone that should look out for her and protect her. And so she comes to this place and she asks, what should I do with my life? A problem that is in the physical. And Jesus says, no, what you need is in the spiritual. You need healing from this abuse. It needs to come into the light. And so we only had 15-minute time slots, and so we did what we could. But I said, would you let me take you to your pastor? And that together we tell him so that he can continue to give you the care and the prayer and the counseling that you're going to need. And she said, yes. So that evening at the meal, I took her and I found her pastor, and together we told him. Do you realize that woman's life is now forever changed? She needed a spiritual answer to a physical problem. She needed hope that her life could be different. I have to imagine she had more than a few torments from this. Just like the woman at the well in this story, her life can now be different. But here's the kicker. Because when I was asked to be on the prophetic prayer team, my first response was, oh man, really? I just want to go sit under a tree somewhere and be lazy. I tried to spiritualize it and be like, oh, I need to go spend time with God, and you know. probably going to end up taking a nap. I resisted doing that. We have to be found at the well. For us to make a difference, for us to bring the good news, we have to be found at the well. That wasn't the only woman we prayed for. We did it for 2 hours, so we prayed for 8 people. And there were several others that were powerfully touched as well. One woman found Candace out the next day and shared a testimony with her of how God had really touched her and changed her and that she would forever be different as well. Back to verse 30. The whole town comes out and they make their way toward Jesus. Suddenly, someone that had had very little contact in that village now has the whole village listening. Why would they believe her? Because she spoke of hope. The world is hungry for hope. Someone that would have easily been dismissed in the past, someone who would have been discredited in the past, now brings a message of hope. And they believe her, which just shows you how hungry people are for hope. The passage ends by saying that many people in the town believed in Jesus. The message of hope that Jesus brought to one woman spreads to that whole town. You know, Renee shared a story with me today that she met this lady in this grocery store, or not a grocery store, Ross. And the lady was simply sharing how she needed some help with something. And Renee's like, I'll help you. And then later Renee's like, oh my gosh, what did I say that for? I have enough to do. And I told Renee, I said, that was an invitation into this woman's family. God doesn't want just this one woman. He wants the whole family. And in the offer of help, you've now been invited into the family so that you can reach more than just one person. But in this passage that we looked at today, there is this radical countercultural message of hope that Jesus brings that we've been looking at. This woman's life was forever changed. And for so many of us, we need to be able to grasp this. We need to be able to internalize that this message of hope is for me too. I talk to way too many people that think, well, that's fine for you, but my situation is worse. My situation is too bad. My sickness is too bad. My sin was too great. Whatever it is, we seem to somehow make ourselves somehow beyond the grace of God. And we think that doesn't apply to me. But his radical message of hope is for everyone. Like I said in my message a couple weeks ago, it's either for everyone or it's for no one. His cross is either big enough for everybody or it's not big enough for anyone. And so this message of hope is something that we all have to lay hold of. But there's also a going to this passage. We need to be found in places where culture says we should not go. It's not always about healing. It's about being found in the Samarias of the world, in our own neighborhoods, in the places in our town where we shouldn't be found. For too long, the religious establishment said Christians shouldn't be there. And that's why there is now coming and taking over us. Of course we're supposed to be there. The light of Christ always overcomes the darkness. There's no darkness that we should fear. So wherever it is in our own community, it doesn't matter. You know, we've had this relationship with this non-alcoholic bar in town where people are in recovery. Let's be there. Heck, let's go to the regular bars. It doesn't matter. There's nothing there we have to fear. We need to be found in the Samarias of the world. We need to go to the places where we're not supposed to be. You know, and I think about even our missions work where, you know, I went to Africa this year. And as I was walking around in Senegal, and people would come up and see a white man in Senegal, which doesn't happen. And they would ask, are you French? Because Senegal used to be a French colony. And I would say, no. And they'd say, well, are you German? No. Are you British? No. And then, well, what are you? I'm American. And they would like, you're an American? One man flat out told me, he goes, Americans never come to Senegal. We need to be found in the Samarias of the world. Jesus wasn't supposed to be in that village, and yet he was. And he talked to one woman, which led a whole town to come to salvation. So often I come across people both in the church and outside the church who are a lot like this woman. They're just getting by, not really aware of their need for the fullness of Jesus. Or they can't receive Jesus because of their religious background. They might respond with, oh, I'm such and such, and refer to a denomination. But it's a barrier to receiving the fullness of Christ. Maybe it's their ancestors. Maybe it's their family. I've had more than one person tell me, I could never come to your church. It would betray, my family to leave the church we grew up in. People need the real message of Jesus and his real message of hope. But this passage shows that none of that matters. That Jesus' message of hope and his message of grace are so powerful, they will overcome all of that junk if we simply embrace it for ourselves and deliver it in love. His message of hope is for everyone. We must embrace it, and we must spread it. Let's stand and sing our last song.